about their own children as they come along. Childhood memories are very often remembrances of mysteries, things happening that affected, but the child never knew why or how or what was happening. The young person was told to do things that he did without understanding. When he was in trouble, he wasn't instructed. When he needed information, he didn't get it. And all these things gradually resulted either in despondency or rebellion. So we have children that sink into themselves because they do not understand life, and there is no one to talk to who really wants to help. Then there are those who are catered to until they're spoiled. All of these different conditions will show lack of judgment, and in the small child, the judgment rests with the parents. And if the parents neglect the child, the adult, from when that child grows up to maturity, is deficient in moral and ethical values. And this goes on and on and on. Now, what happens? What is all this memory business about, anyway? We are going to lie down one of these days and rest, as they said, with our fathers. What happens to these things? Does memory die with us? Is it something that is only a record of what we fail to do in this embodiment? Is the memory that we take forward only a summary of our own mistakes? Or is there something more to it? Did some previous memory bring us into our present condition? And some subsequent condition is going to be affected by our present memory. As far as the universe is concerned, what difference does it make whether we remember or not? Actually, our own small lives cannot be regarded as being of sufficient importance to cause the universe to be stirred by our personal delinquencies. So what does it all add up to? Well, Buddha and some of the older teachers, in fact some today, are thinking in the same way, that this memory factor is part of our entire cosmic lesson. It is part of the reason for ourselves, for this memory is of vital importance to ourselves. And because of this vital memory's importance, it isn't necessary for our lives to be overshadowed by some outside factor. It is overshadowed, perhaps, by the memories which are locked within our own eternal natures. The brain goes. The mind is gradually absorbed into the higher vehicles of life and is once more identified with universal mind. But the thoughts that we think do not die. Something happens to them. The way of life that we have lived now bears witness to something that once was. If we come into this world with a dream, it's because we went out of the world before with a dream. If we come in with a nightmare, it's because we brought a nightmare with us. And what was the nightmare? It was the carelessness, thoughtlessness, selfishness of previous embodiments uncorrected. There is no solution to the problem of the human being except personal reformation, the activation of those powers within the self by means of which we can bring life into pattern and order. Everyone has a certain amount of memory, a certain amount of experience knowledge. In some cases, it is comparatively slight. In other cases, it is more highly advanced. But in everyone, there is something that can contribute to the rectification of character. So we come in to the present embodiment without any conscious realization of what we were before. But today, while we are here, from day to day, we gradually lose realization of the earlier years of our own lives. The weakness of our own minds results in a kind of forgetfulness. We forget what we have never learned, but we remember that which is most deeply etched upon memory. That's the reason why nearly all of our arts are more highly developed than any other branch of learning. This is because arts were with us from very ancient times. We had arts before we had languages, that is, written languages. We had arts long before we had sciences. Therefore, the musician has to practice every day. The painter has to learn the rules of his art and keep those rules. The musician, the singer, has to practice every day or loses control of the voice. So if a child is born with one of these aptitudes, it's because he has disciplined himself. Now, this doesn't mean he has disciplined every phase of his nature, but he has disciplined something. And that which he brings forward is the asset resulting from personal discipline. Now, once discipline is attained, it can be diversified. It may be that the individual learned in the past to play a violin and gave maybe 50, 60 years to constant practice toward the perfection of that skill. This ability may come down into the present embodiment, but there is also a skill of decision and dedication which may enable this person to diversify into some other field, but have the discipline to carry on. So anyone who has no aptitude has not disciplined his own mind. He hasn't done the work that was necessary to create a pattern of self-control, by means of which, without effort on his own part, the mind does its work well. It takes care of the problems that come along. It thinks common sense, and also reminds the person constantly of his own responsibility for personal conduct. Now, if through the life we're living now, we do add something to this discipline, perhaps we add a new focus to it. Perhaps we decide to do something else. But we still make a decision. Today, a great many decisions are being made in science, probably more than ever before. And the reason is that the persons who go into science are persons who have a long background of mental disciplines. Now, when they came into the world, they had no knowledge of these disciplines. But inside themselves, they had a kind of dedication. They had a sense of searching for significance. They wanted to do something, and when they found out what it was, they went into it heart and soul, because they had already learned to go into things with heart and soul. So in the sciences, their progress is rapid, because the matter is of significance to the individual. It is something that survives the shifting of time. Now, there are things that we can learn in one embodiment which are no longer any value to us in the future. Then all that we have is the discipline we have gained, but we must find new outlets for it. But always, if we have disciplined the mind at some time, some way, it is available as a pattern of integrities when we need strength of character. So if we don't get too far, even in this life, presuming that we don't fulfill all the dreams that we have, if we go out of this world better disciplined than we were before, the life is a success. And the proof of this better discipline is the fact that we are able to lead our own characters more effectively and with greater integrity. So little by little, the things that do not count drop away. It may well be that in some previous embodiment we made chariots, but they're not making them anymore, and there's no use making chariots. But if we've learned to make chariots, we can learn to do other things. We find that we can control skill, that we can make our hands and minds do the things we want them to do. We have what we call abilities or aptitudes. And today, young people all over the world are running around trying to find out what their aptitudes are. And some of them never find out because they haven't had any yet. But they're going to stay on working at it. They're going to find themselves frustrated. They're going to find themselves at the bottom of a heap instead of at the top. Until finally, they gain enough character to revolt against their own lack of discipline. So discipline is probably the greatest secret in the world. And discipline united with dedication is probably the highest form of life that we can attain. But discipline tied into other less desirable facts or processes with delinquencies and things of this nature can be a very terrible penalty upon us. Now, at the end of each life, this mind thing seems to retire. And in the way of retiring, it seems to go gradually, something like the development and collapse of a universe. Little by little, the material and matters and substances of life, the mental life of the individual, gradually fade out. They go into a dark hole of unknown and unknowing. We do not know where they came from, but we know that gradually, in the end of things, there is a gradual decline of individuality, and things move into the great dark unknown. Now, the great dark unknown is not really dark, and it is not a formidable or dangerous thing. For most persons, the unknown is nothing but truth. Most people just don't know about it. The unknown is strange because we haven't experienced it. We are afraid of it because we do not understand it. We do not dare to trust ourselves upon it because for us it might be merely some kind of a vacuum. But actually, when we get to the end of all of these conditioned existences through which we pass, we are gradually coming to the final reason for ourselves. We are not going on to infinity with skills in bookkeeping or in skills in industry or as bankers and lawyers and doctors. These are aspects of skills that are gained through discipline. But the great discipline itself, per se, apart from any object of discipline, means final, the overcoming of all limitation, all negation, all inaptitude, all ignorance within the self. And when the disciplines all are complete, when the individual is no more to learn here by any of the means available to him, or has gained a point where the values of life have become clearly sketched for his consciousness, he then finds himself on the edge of the mystery of his own survival, because the nature does not demand that the individual repeat himself. He doesn't have to go through time after time lessons that he has already learned. He goes to take the lessons that he has not learned. And when there are no longer lessons that he has not learned, then his participation in the mortal sphere devoted to lessons is no longer relevant. The person fades out of the imperfect by transcending it. As long as there is no conflict between inner consciousness and the realities of nature, the individual is not subject to natural infirmities. He is only subject to the mistakes that he makes, and when he stops making them, he is no longer subject to their consequences. This is, in a sense, the answer to the Indian concept of karma. There are some that feel that karma goes on forever, and that you are paying for your own sins countless times, and that you are making the same mistake countless times, and this goes on forever. No legitimate system of philosophy has ever taught that, or believed it, or wanted anyone else to believe it. The reason why the individual is under karma is because he has failed various lessons along the way. His failure is usually through ignorance, because ignorance itself is the weakening factor. The ignorant person has not the courage to live well. This is one of the important areas of thought. He is weak because he is ignorant. He is ignorant because he is weak. And in the compound of these factors, he continues to make the mistakes by which he is subjected to karma. But when this type of duty is at an end, he is no longer subject to karma. In the Mahayana system of Buddhism, as taught in China, Japan, and most parts of Asia, the individual who finally attains the complete release from the cycle of mistakes had gradually impersonalized himself. The bodhisattva, or the highest attainment of man as an individual, the human being as an individual, is one in whom all of the mistakes of life have ceased. They have ceased because he will not set the causes in motion that bring them. He will not allow any imperfection to remain uncorrected in his own nature. He is not being saved by anybody but himself, even as he cannot be lost except by his own mistakes, and even those will ultimately be corrected. The bodhisattva, or the perfectly enlightened soul, achieves the edge of eternity. Nothing more to be learned here. What lies beyond here is the question that still goes on, and for which there is no immediate answer. But according to the Northern Buddhist concept, the perfected soul stands, so to say, on the rim of existence. He stands in the presence of the great silence, the great darkness, the great mystery, the mysterious thing that to all creation appears to be a vacuum. He is therefore in the presence of an unconditioned. He has deserved liberation because he has perfected all of the vehicles with which he has been endowed. He has gone through hundreds of incarnations and become a truly enlightened being, and he has a choice to make. He can either go on into this unknown, this hole or darkness, the dark hole in which there is no memory, there is nothing. Or else he can pause and say to himself, if I go on, the entire cycle of material or mortal conditions through which I have passed ends. I am no longer even aware of the past. I am not aware of anything that I have previously known. I have no sense of knowledge within myself. Knowledge has gone to sleep with ignorance. The whole thing is finished. But I still exist. I have a strange existence which enables me to say that I exist. A senseness of reality. Now, if I step through into that dark hole, will that die also? Will that be then the complete extermination of a being? And the powers that be haven't given him a very good answer to that, because they expect him to make up his own mind. But the answer seems to be that what he calls the dark hole, or the inevitable, the universal, the infinite, the unconditioned, the primordial, that which was before beginnings, that is actually the beginning of something else. The being does not cease, but goes into an entirely different dimension of existence, an existence in which the lessons that it has learned here prepares it for that unknown future, which is infinitely beyond anything that we know here. The reason why he has to be perfected before he can go there is because that which is there demands a higher degree of attainment than any individual can completely accomplish in this world. So the being stands there on the border of existence. And then, according to the Buddhist Mahayana doctrine, there is a pause. Because the last emotion that the individual has, when everything else has gone and ceased, when all ambitions have died, when all dreams have fulfilled themselves or faded away, what is the last single thread that holds the human consciousness to existence? And in Buddhism, that single thread is love. And that love has as its major expression compassion. The Maitreya Buddha, the Buddha to come, or the Buddhist state in man to come, is called compassion. Infinite tenderness toward all that lives. So the being standing on the gate of eternity, or at the gate, has a choice, the last choice it can make. It can either go on into that infinite which it has earned, and which it as yet is not able to find a definition, or it can turn back and become a servant, a server of human beings who have not yet attained. And in the northern system of Buddhism, those who turn back are the bodhisattvas, the great servers, the ones who have given up their own eternity in order to make certain, as the Konnan Rotsatsu taught, that when it finally goes into this infinite eternal, it will take with it every creature that exists in the world. It cannot and will not go till with it all living things can come to the same end. So in Buddhism, there is this strange concept of this hole in the dark, the darkness of the unknown, the ultimate unknown. Some religions try to fulfill this mystery in the concept of identity with God. Well, this probably is it. But the identity with God is not what we think of it as identity with God. It is not some kind of a paradisical state. It is not a state in which there is no longer labor. It is not a state of finish, finally. It is a state of a transcendent destiny beyond what we know. It is something that means that the particles of individuality have faded away, have disappeared, have been drawn into the mysterious vacuum of eternity. But they still exist. And beyond this, there is still other realms that must be reached. That life is eternal, growth is eternal, and ultimately, the state of the human being is unknowable as far as its ultimate condition is concerned. But we know that it's going to be transcendently unknowable. It will be infinite in its unknowing, but it will be perfect. Perfection lies somewhere at the other end of a great tube or channel that leads to all the kingdoms of nature. It is a constant disappearing from a condition to reappear in a higher condition. It is going to sleep in this world to awaken in a world of reality. And to accomplish this, the path has been given. Now, the path is always the same, and yet it has many names also. Discipline is the main name, but discipline is also humility. It is detachment from all known vice or excess. It is infinite tenderness toward all that lives. It is a desire to sacrifice self for that which is less than self. It is the certainty that we must take with us the realization that each enlightened being becomes the parent of millions and must lead them to the same perfection. It makes the enlightened person not free, but completely involved. It becomes not free from responsibility, but the head of a family and responsibilities increasing every day. But it is a responsibility in harmony with divine law. It is responsibility such as we think of the responsibility of Christ or the responsibility of God for creation. All things are responsible according to what they know. And the growth is knowing more and gaining more responsibility. In the esoteric teachings of the ages, there is no such a thing as laziness. There is no such a thing as the individual free forever from the responsibilities of life. there is only increasing responsibility and the fulfillment of the inner self in selfless service to all that lives. So this way goes through the mind and the brain and the heart. And the intellectual way of going is through gaining the knowledge primarily to help us to serve others. The doctor becomes a physician in order to serve the sick. The teacher becomes a leader in schools because of the desire to teach the ignorant. The parent becomes a parent in order to protect offspring. All leaders that are fit to be leaders carry the responsibility for those they lead. In none of these is there a kind of temporal satisfaction. There is no pride in leadership. There is humility. There is no desire to climb up on other people, but rather to lift up other people to each a higher destiny. There is nothing to be done by selfishness, no vainglory, no pride of opinion, no honor in wealth. All these things are experiences of the mind that must be carried, must be solved, must be outgrown, but in the meantime must be used every day for the benefit of all that lives. Thus, all the solutions that we seek can come only when the individual overcomes the instinct to the ego, the instinct to be greater than somebody else. Because truly, the one that would be the greatest among us must be the servant of all. And all growth, minds becoming stronger and more brilliant, artists painting better, philosophers thinking clearer, all of these things are part of a growth in which all work together. The great with the less great, the greater with the more great, all working toward the completion of the great purpose, the perfection of all that lives. And we all have the chance of having some part in this story, some participation in this great pattern of things. And we do it, first of all, by getting rid of the impairments, the inhibitions that make us unable to grow. One, of course, is unkindness. Another is pride. Another is unwillingness to forgive an enemy. Still another is ambition to outstrip someone else. And, of course, one of the commonest ones today is the profit system. The desire always for wealth. For what? In order that we can have greater luxury, that we can be more affluent than our neighbors. But all this goes into the dark hole and never comes out. There is no solution here. Humility, simplicity, dignity, world sharing, doing for others, finding common ground for the peace of nations. Only through kindness and unselfishness can leaders bring their people to security. And only a world devoted to common service can prevent the constant danger of warfare and crime. Oh, no more revenge, no more cruelty, but a determination to make friends wherever possible. And where we cannot achieve friendship, never work for the opposite, but give a blessing and hope well for all concerned. Never continue any evil thoughts or any destructive habits that are apt to interfere with the mind becoming a faithful servant. After all, the power of the mind, ultimately, is to become a kind of Plato or a kind of Socrates or anything that has great solutions to the daily problems. The mind becomes the leader of the life of the individual by proving what can be done and why. But the purpose of the mind is to rectify the emotions. For no matter how much the world thinks or how much the individual thinks, unless this thought brings with it compassion. Unless this thought causes the individual to sacrifice himself for the good of others. Therefore, universal love. It is wisdom that makes love sensible. It is wisdom that makes a love reasonable. It takes the superficial emotion and makes it something that justifies our affection, that makes our love real. And a love that is not real is not love at all. But wisdom leads the way. Plato is said in his older years to have said that all wisdom has but one end, that man shall build strength and sound foundation under faith. Faith is the final emotion, and faith is the acceptance of the fact that existence is something we should be grateful for, that we should love the infinite plan and do everything we can to prove that we are willing to cooperate with it. Prayer is void unless this prayer is dedicated to the love and development of all that lives. So not thinking of self, but thinking always of the greater good, memory becomes much stronger. After a while, I've talked to people who have given up most of the world's beliefs in order to have simple lives of service. And I've said, what does memory mean to you now? How do you remember things? And they said, we don't remember anymore, really. We have no memories. We are too busy serving. There is no longer any question. But the thing that has made that possible is that the memory and the mind did bring the individual to a degree of discrimination in which the individual was able to know that which was next, that which was the most important, and that which was the perfect expression of faith, devotion, love, and service. So the memory finally gives us a release from itself because it comes to us as a dedication rather than an attitude. It comes to us as a full realization of the wonder and beauty of the divine purpose. So we are all sort of moving towards an unknown cosmic end, like little atoms floating in a sunbeam. We are going towards a great something in which all existence as we know it is absorbed, returns to the root of itself, fades away, vanishes away in the infinite. But this vanishment of existence is not itself eternal. In due time, these atoms will come forth again, in higher pattern, in greater perfection, with more nobility of purpose. And one of these days, all going well in our own consciousness, leading us in the right direction, someday, in the inconceivable fullness of time and eternity, we shall discover the true meaning of the infinite. We shall find ourselves one with the eternal love that has protected us all the way and is the love in ourselves, and that this will flow forth again into the infinite, and upon this foundation will be built a creation that will never fail. For once we have created correctly, we have achieved eternity. This is the doctrine of the alchemists. Immortal life is the result of the individual removing from his character all imperfections, all conflicts, all dissensions, not by weakness, not by agreeing with that which is not true, but by a complete dedication in which there is no longer temptation to make a mistake, because there is nothing the individual wants any longer except that truth which can never be a mistake. And so in that sense, we are floating in the mysterious beams of life, and like tiny atoms floating in a sunbeam, we are part of this great plan, and we are all moving toward unity once more with the infinite source of all that lives. Well, I guess that's it for this morning, folks.